This is Johnny Bluestar. Welcome to Threshold, a global media event. Is the universe just a random dance of atoms? Or is it a manifestation of a supremely intelligent architect? Can its purpose, or our purpose here on Earth, be adequately assessed? Can we commune with it, know its intentions, cooperate with its direction? Here, we define Threshold as a gateway state of awareness, allowing mankind to cross into a place of real cognition. Threshold allows us to approach questions of higher reality through the door of experience rather than mere belief. Welcome to Threshold, where we tear away the veil from commercial media, bringing our audience and participants into another realm of reality and enhanced communication. Welcome back to Threshold. We have with us Charles Rick Perry, an attorney who has helped many small businesses at their earliest stages. One of the things we've been discussing are contracts, which also sometimes include boilerplate.
Well, also about contracts, you were talking about boilerplate, but there's also, you know, another way of looking at things is some boilerplate is in fine print, and it's fine. It's just hard to read. But some things are buried in fine print that are really quite detrimental to the signer in certain cases. What should people look out for?
Probably the one provision that you would always want to look out for is something that looks like either a limitation of liability or an indemnity provision. And basically what they are saying is, look, if something goes wrong, my liability to you is limited to the purchase price of the contract, for instance, or, you know, 6 months of payments under the contract or something like that, you know, which makes it economically irrational to sue and pursue it because the remedy will be so small at the end of the day. And that the time that you will spend to collect will be completely out, you know, will completely outweigh what you will ever have a right to collect. And those types of provisions are often enforceable. A jurisdiction, you should be working out for a jurisdiction provision where you live in California, but if you have a problem, the lawsuit would have to be brought in New York. That would be another provision that you need to be aware of. The one provision that gets a lot of press from time to time, particularly, I believe it's in cell phone contracts, although, well, yes, in cell phone contracts, I believe is where it comes, although I could easily be wrong there. Okay. It's what's called an evergreen provision, which means that the contract automatically renews if you don't give 60, 90 days notice. Contract for a year, 2 years, and 2 years runs, and you don't say anything, and bam, it renews for another 2 years, and you're stuck. That's a provision people should pay attention to. You know, and these are all provisions that those who are drafting the form contracts will put into their GTs and Cs, their general terms and conditions, or their boilerplate, or their fine print. And those are the things that you need to pay attention to. And quite frankly, if you're in the position of drafting general terms and conditions, you would want to discuss with a lawyer to see how much you can get away with, whether they're enforceable, what to do if somebody decides to read them and challenge them, and the like.
You know, a lot of people, they've signed the contract, and it's over with, that part of it. Are they okay? Is there anything else they have to look out for that might influence the way the contract is actually carried out?
Well, I think they need to make sure that the contract is followed, and they do what they say they agreed to do, because if, you know, I just finished litigating a very large case in which the company did a very good job of outlining its relationship with its chief executive officer and a major shareholder in the company. And then they basically put the contract in a drawer and ignored it. You know, they didn't have the meetings they said they were going to have. And they didn't define keep the rules of the lines of responsibility the way they said they were going to do, and you know they didn't follow exactly the salary procedures or salary requirements that they said they were going to do. They just kind of all made it up as they went along. They just kept changing it orally and agreeing between them, which basically made the contract useless. Because the court's going to look at the reality of the situation and how people behaved to see if, in essence, they really meant what the contract said or they agreed not to follow it.
Well, if they do that, if they both disagree with it, what is the criteria for settling a dispute?
Essentially, the court looks for what did the parties agree to afterwards. And so they will look at statements made back and forth between the two of them. Email chains have become incredibly important in that regard. And they will look at their behavior. They will look to see what they signed, what they did, what they should have done but didn't do, and the whole nine yards. And so you end up with a dispute that really examines the history of the parties as to figure out what it is they agreed to and didn't agree to, and not simply whether or not they performed or didn't perform the contract. And then, of course, in those situations, you always end up into a person A said, person B said scenario. And so instead of having the clarity of the contract, you have a lot of finger pointing.
Well, what if you are accused of breaching a contract or someone breaches your contract? How do you avoid getting into a real prolonged and complex lawsuit?
Usually the best way to do that is to engage in a conversation, is to not ignore it. If you think the other person is really serious about pursuing it, and getting back to them and saying, whatever it is you need to say that is the truth, that will help minimize the problem. If the breach of the contract is, you haven't paid, for instance, to negotiate as best you can an appropriate payment plan. If there is a problem with the product, to see what the problem is and see if you can find a solution to the product. I mean, the odd story here is just you're raising this flash that's in my brain is the notorious lawsuit against McDonald's about coffee that was too hot.
Oh, and yes, I remember that.
A sort of an urban legend about this woman who buys a cup of coffee. I think it's in a drive-thru is how the story goes. And the coffee is far too hot, and she spills it on her lap, and she scalds herself. And she ends up going to trial, and she wins a huge amount of money. And if you look at the backstory of that, the story that makes up the urban legend is true as far as it goes. But what's not told is the fact that the lady who spilled did write a letter to McDonald's and did say, I would like an apology and here are some of my medical bills and it's clear that your coffee was too hot. Please take care of this. And essentially, if the rest of this is understood, McDonald's didn't give her an appropriate response if that part of the story is to be believed. And it escalated into a lawsuit. And one has to wonder what might have happened if, and again, assuming that this part of the story is true, that the woman did write this letter and did ask for a small amount of compensation, had McDonald's taken care of it, this problem might never have escalated and exploded the way that it did.
Wow, that's a really good answer to that question. But there is a point in a situation where you might truly need legal assistance after a contractual dispute. What is that point where you stop the negotiation and the talking and you say, okay, I'm getting a lawyer?
One obvious point is when the other side gets a lawyer. Because, then without the lawyer, it's kind of like bringing a knife to a gunfight. You just have somebody who's so familiar, an expert in the system of dispute resolution with skill sets that you as an individual or as a business person just don't have. So that's one. Two is you're simply exasperated and the conversation is going nowhere and you need a second opinion as to, whether or not you're making a mistake, whether or not you're right and the other side is as out of their minds, whether there are other solutions. Bringing a neutral in will be helpful. Three is obviously a cost perspective. You're not going to bring a lawyer in if it's a $300 dispute. You're just not. It's not going to be cost effective. You're just going to want to cut a deal and move on. Those would be kinds of the the considerations. One may be that it is simply chewing up way too much of your time and that you need somebody in there that can do things for you instead, that it's simply an expensive delegation process. That would be another reason. You know, and a lot of disputes can be resolved with two good lawyers getting together, looking at the dispute, looking at the problem, and then looking at their clients and saying, cut a deal, get this over with and behind you.
What have been some of your biggest challenges when helping someone in the early stages of starting a small business?
I think that the issue is always one of adjusting expectations without saying no. Entrepreneurs, by definition, are optimists. They wouldn't be taking the risks that they run if they weren't optimistic about a favorable outcome. They're ideas people, and they are hard workers, and they're usually quite smart, and they're creative, and they're willing to take risks. And lawyers, by definition, are trained to minimize risks. You know, that's a lot of what we do for small businesses. You know, we draft clear contracts to minimize risks and exposures. We help people form corporations to minimize risks and exposures. We look at downsides a lot. And sometimes, quite frankly, we have to say, no, you can't do that. That's illegal. And so there's always a balance between the inherent naysaying nature of a lawyer and the optimistic nature of the entrepreneur, coupled with the experience of seeing so many businesses start and not succeed, and knowing that the risks, as a general rule, are not quite as optimistic or as quite as favorable for the entrepreneur as he or she portrays them. That, I think, is always the biggest challenge. And to get them to see that it's not always their way or the highway, that there are additional ways of getting to achieve the goal that might be more prudent.
Patricia Welch is clearly one of the most accomplished singers living today. Recently, she created a wonderful CD set called Great Entertaining, Cocktails, Dinner, and Dessert with Patricia. We have two complete shows with Patricia, show number 4, Evolution of a Singer, and show number 14, Cocktails with Patricia. You can find them at our Threshold Radio archives at VegasOnNetRadio.com and YouTube. Here's one of her songs.
What do you get when you fall in love? A guy with a pin to burst your bubble. That's what you get for all your trouble. I'll never fall in love again. I'll never fall in love again. What do you get when you kiss a guy? You get enough germs to catch pneumonia. After you do, he'll never phone ya. I'll never fall in love again. Don't you know that I'll never fall in love again? Don't tell me what it's all about, 'cause I've been there and I'm glad I'm out. Out of those chains that bind you. That is why I'm here to remind you. What do you get when you fall in love? You only get lies and pain and sorrow. So for at least until tomorrow, I'll never fall in love again. No, no, I'll never fall in love again.
This is Johnny Bluestar. I've worked as a lyricist with Patricia Welch for over 5 years, along with Russian composer Edgar Ahrens, a friend and colleague. Her ability as a singer is simply amazing. She brings a unique and dramatic flair to every song she sings. Over the next few months, we shall be releasing a number of these songs, part of an album called Hadley's Castle. Meanwhile, Patricia has been busy creating a super enjoyable collection of classic standards in an exciting 46-song, 3-CD collection.
Music for Great Entertaining introduces Cocktails, Dinner, and Dessert with Patricia Welch. 3 hours of continuous music. 46 of the all-time classic standards, spanning decades of hit songs. Going to a friend's home for dinner? Cocktails, dinner, and dessert with Patricia also makes the perfect hostess gift. This 3-CD compilation is the perfect background music that sets just the right mood for any dinner party.
I'm crazy for feeling so lonely. There was a boy, a very strange, enchanted boy.
To purchase this album, just go to patriciawelch.com/CD. That is patriciawelch.com/CD. You won't be disappointed.
It is the 15th century. El Tesoro de Cielo, a Spanish treasure ship, sends a scouting expedition to a strange island. Golden statues surrounding them prove the enormity of their find. Suddenly, hordes of ghoulish creatures with scaly green flesh and skeletal wings descend upon them from the sky.
What do you think of this, Rufio?
These creatures are fragile, Captain. We can take them with our swords.
They seem supernatural. Who knows what powers they possess?
Fallen angels, weakened by their treason.
By God, are you saying they're Nephilim, the devil's host?
I'm saying whatever they are, we can take them. Do any of you cowards dare join me?
Up against sharp knife-like nails and hideous fangs, the men's swords rip into slimy green flesh. Though black blood pours copiously from their half-naked bodies, creatures miraculously persist. Can the crew survive this bloody, cursed battle?
Find out more by Googling The Thrice Born, a new sci-fi supernatural novel by Carlos Lopez Avery and Johnny Bluestar. Google with the words Carlos Johnny Kendall, The Thrice Born. That's Carlos Johnny Kendall, The Thrice Born.
We're back with attorney Rick Perry discussing the ins and outs of starting a small business. You know, Rick, one of the things that happens to a person who's just starting a business, they realize, you know, there is a liability problem. They don't want to be sued for the full extent of their personal fortune, but there's a complexity in getting a legal entity like a corporation or LLC to protect themselves. And oftentimes they don't even really understand what these entities are. Maybe you could go into that, the difference between a proprietorship or a LLC or a corporation and maybe different types of these categories of these entities.
Okay. A corporation and an LLC are really two variations on the same theme. And what they are basically fictitious people, if you will. In other words, the law looks at them and treats the legally created entity of a corporation or of a limited liability company as a person that has its own tax number, that has its own set of liabilities, that has its own set of books, that has its own set of contracts, that has its own being from this point of view of the legal system. Okay, and what it does is it creates a person, if you will, that is separate and that does lots of things, and that the people behind it are simply the agents, you know, the people that make it work. Okay, but it is a completely different entity. They're wearing a completely different hat, if you will, while they are working on behalf of the LLC or the corporation. So the contracts that this business signs are in the names of the corporation and not the person who actually physically signed the pieces of paper. And it is the corporation that would be liable, or the LLC that would be liable. And it would be the LLC that would have to bring the lawsuit, or more importantly, the LLC that would have to be paid, that would be sued. So that's in essence what it is. And because the corporation or the LLC is in essence a person, it does take a little bit of care and feeding to make sure that your person does not die. You've got to maintain the documents, and you've got to keep the separate bank accounts, and you've got to make sure that it's got, you know, its own contracts, and that you're not mixing your money with the money of the entities. You've got responsibilities to the other owners and whatnot. So, but that is basically what a corporation or an LLC are. Are there differences between the two? Yes. An LLC generally has a lot more flexibility in terms of how it can be managed. The rules that are set out in the law are not quite as strict. The owners have a lot more flexibility about how profits and losses are to be divided, how equity is divided, and how managerial responsibility is to be divided among the owners. Assuming, of course, that there is more than one owner. And in most cases, you don't technically need more than one owner. A one-person LLC is quite a common occurrence. But that is basically what the corporation or the LLC is for. It's to create a separate person which has separate tax liabilities and which it can basically absorb liabilities of the business.
Well, so what about the, you know, I realize that a corporation, you know, you often hear a C corp and an S corp, right? Could you explain the differences between those?
Sure. A C corp and an S corp are basically tax designations. The IRS basically has said, look, if you are a C corporation, which comes from subchapter C of the tax code, we will basically treat your corporation as a separate person, and we will tax that the profits and losses of the corporation as a completely separate entity. Okay, so if the corporation earns $10,000, then the corporation pays a tax on $10,000. Okay, and if dividends are distributed out to the shareholders for, you know, $2,000, then the shareholders get taxed on the $2,000 as dividends. It is the classic situation of, in essence, what's called double taxation, once at the corporate level and once at the individual level. And that's kind of the classic corporate structure that has existed for years and years and years. The S corporation is a specific designation under the Internal Revenue Code, which basically says, you know, we qualify to opt out of that system where income is taxed at the corporate level. What we will do is basically flow through to the shareholders all of the tax, all of the income, and just tax that income once at the shareholder level.
Right.
And it's a big calculation at the beginning of the life of the corporation, whether or not you're going to be taxed as a C corporation or as an S corporation, whether you qualify in the first place, and whether that makes sense given the individual tax positions and liabilities of the various shareholders.
Well, what about a partnership? Do you think that's, say, a general partnership to start out with, do you think that's a risky situation without, you know, whereas you could get maybe an entity to work with?
Well, if you're in a general partnership, you know, if Johnny and Rick decide to go open their infamous cafe together as a partnership, then Johnny and Rick are both individually liable for all of the contracts and losses that might occur to the corporation. So if somebody spills coffee on themselves and we have made a mistake and the coffee was too hot and they scald themselves, then for better or for worse, Johnny and Rick are personally liable. There is no shield there to protect them from that particular liability. The general partnership also has the problems of, you know, when Johnny and Rick have a problem with each other, that is probably the most expensive type of fight to fight out because of the duties that Johnny and Rick owe each other in terms of managing the partnership and keeping track of the money and not running competing businesses and not keeping secrets and the like. The advantage, of course, is that it is the simplest structure. Everything's owned 50-50. Everything's clear. What's yours is mine. What's mine is yours. And it is the easiest and the quickest to get up and running if you decide that you want to be in business with somebody else. And there are lots of partnerships that function quite well, that don't have a problem These partnerships take care of most of their liability risks by insuring around them, by having good insurance in place. It is viable. It all kind of depends upon what the business is and what the risks are, how much the people trust each other, whether or not things are really going should be divided equally between the two of them, or the three of them, or however many partners there are.
Are there different categories for LLCs, like S-Corp and C-Corp, this type of thing, or are they basically sort of the same thing, except modified by the different state requirements?
Well, remember that the C-Corporation and the S-Corporation is a tax designation by the federal government, and it applies to the LLC regardless of what state the LLC is incorporated in. And if you're looking at the state tax level on the state entity creation level, you really need to look at each state's codes as to how they behave. California does have a fairly complicated set of rules as to how it's going to tax LLCs and corporations and the elections that people can make, although it's not quite the same as the rules for an S corporation and a C corporation, and I quite frankly don't know what other states do and don't do in that regard.
Well, about the story that a lot of people hear is that they should open a Delaware or Nevada corporation, no matter where they live. Does that have any validity to it? Is there any reason that they should, or if so, when should they?
The Nevada and the Delaware corporate laws are historically known for being the most flexible in terms of the structure of their internal management and operations, and the powers that the directors and officers have vis-a-vis what the powers the shareholders have. Generally speaking, for the small entity, they probably should, and my tendency generally is to advise them to incorporate in the state where they're going to do business, because those advantages are usually not horribly important for the small entity. And even if they were, you're going to need to register your Nevada or your Delaware corporation in the state in which you do business, in which you have your office, which means you get bound by most of those states' rules and all of those states' taxes, regardless of whether the state starts and create or wherever the state of incorporation is. And so, because the big issue for so many people is the tax issue, and because Nevada and Delaware, if you're operating in California or New York or Utah, don't give you any advantages because you're operating in New York and in California and Utah, and you have to pay those states' taxes, there really isn't a huge advantage to incorporating in Delaware or Nevada these days. The one exception might be is if you have a truly internet business, uh-huh, where there is no physical presence. And even then, you'd really have to sit down and look at it and see, do I get to avoid registering in the state where I operate with my garage? And sometimes the answer to that is, well, you have to register that anyway. And then the question does become, well, what's the point?
Here's some information about the incredible compositional artistry of my friend and colleague, Russian composer Edgar Arens.
I've worked with Russian composer Edgar Arens for quite a few years, building an inventory of songs, many of which feature singer-performer Patricia Welch. We will soon be releasing these songs, components of an album and a musical in progress called Hadley's Castle. When Edgar and I first got together, I was amazed by the brilliance of his musical scores created for movies, TVs, and animations. Here is a sample of the work he did on the Russian TV series, available now on Amazon, called The Secret Agent's Memoir, which had 2 seasons. This score is called Escape and was created for the first season. I am very pleased to say that Bridge of Light Productions, a division of New Galaxy Enterprises, is proud to be the contact point for television and film companies seeking information about this amazing composer's work. If you're in the entertainment business and wish to know more, contact me at johnnybluestar@gmail.com. That's johnnybluestar@gmail.com.
The following is from West Side Warrior, the memoir of Ray Boylan, a Korean War veteran and crime fighter. He was there fighting in the world's coldest battlefield when the Chinese communists invaded.
Desperate squad members ran past our foxhole yelling, "Get the hell out of here! There's too many of them!" Again, we saw the Chinese soldiers charging in with opium-induced mindlessness, oblivious of our bullets. Again, we heard the bugles and whistles. Climbing out of our foxhole, Bob dropped two hand grenades behind us, and I threw one over my shoulder. Bullets whizzing by our heads, Bob and I became bolts of lightning flashing across the mountainside. Like a hideous film, desperate scenes like this played out on the Tokong Pass for 3 days. Sometimes I played in the scene. Sometimes I could only watch and wonder if it were real, or if I'd be suddenly jolted out of my trance by an RKO usher saying, "Hey, did you kids sneak in here?"
To acquire this book, Google westsidewarrior.boylan.kindle. Boylan is spelled B-O-Y-L-A-N. That's West Side Warrior, Boylan, Kindle.
If you like Threshold Radio, a program which deals with core issues affecting our personal, political, and spiritual lives, and advocates the creation of an enlightened, informed citizenry, not only in America, but throughout the world, then you might think of supporting both your product and business and our message by advertising on our show. All programs are archived and are supported in various ways, including social media, our outreach being broadcast weekly on VegasAllNetRadio.com, a very advanced internet broadcasting station, but also archived directly on our websites on YouTube and in SoundCloud. We believe in time we will have a very broad outreach. Through New Galaxy Enterprises, our parent company, we can create a wide range of marketing and advertising components to complement your advertising on Threshold Radio and increase your outreach in many creative and exciting ways. If interested, just go to www.thresholdradio.com and fill out a contact form with your interest. That's www.thresholdradio.com.
Back with attorney Rick Perry, who has been cluing us as to both the spirit and technical legalities of starting your own small business. You know, we talked about in the beginning the nuts and bolts of forming a sole proprietorship. What do you need to do to form some of these entities? What is the sort of bottom line there in terms of what the forms you need? And should you use a lawyer? Or can you use an online program like LegalZoom?
Let's break this question down. The nuts and bolts for the legal aspect of either a corporation or an LLC is actually fairly simple. And I'm going to talk in California here because this is where I'm licensed to practice and I know the system. The basic forms that you need to create the entity, meaning get it born, if you will, are online with the Secretary of State. And they're very, very short forms where you really only have to answer a half dozen questions. What is the name of the entity? Who are the organizers? There are a couple of legal questions that you have to probably answer. Is, you know, for an LLC, it's going to ask you if it's a manager or an owner-managed or member-managed LLC. You may have to answer questions for corporations as to how many classes of shares you're going to answer. So those are going to require a bit of specialized knowledge. But if you do a little bit of homework and do some reading from any kind of online source or books that you can get on the bookstore or online to get a basic understanding of those general differences, you're likely going to be okay. Underlying those forms are going to be a more complicated set of documents. For a corporation, for instance, you're going to have what are called bylaws and what are called minutes. Bylaws are basically a document that sets forth how the corporation is going to work. When are the votes going to be held? How many directors are there going to be? How often they're going to meet? What it takes to call a meeting? Basic internal operations of the organization. And the minutes are basically the record of what was decided. an LLC has a similar set of documents. It's not called bylaws, it's called an operating agreement, but it essentially serves the same function. You know, again, if you go to your favorite bookstore or your favorite online place and get a book on how to form a California corporation or how to form a California LLC, or if you want a New York or Delaware or Nevada entity, you know, use those states instead. The online texts are probably pretty good, or those texts are probably pretty good about giving you an overview. They've been around for a long time. They can be used. Can you do this by yourself or through LegalZoom? Yes, you can. There's nothing that says you need to have a lawyer. The thing that you do need to understand is that it's a garbage in, garbage out idea.
Yeah.
Okay? Mm-hmm. And, you know, if all you really need are pieces of paper that says my name, Inc. on it, it's fine. If you think you can get by with a generic understanding of what the LegalZoom text or the other online text or online books can provide you, it's fine. But it's kind of like saying, gee, you know, is building my home a DIY project, or do I need a contractor to help me? Yeah, you probably can build it yourself, but there will probably be things that'll be a lot better if you bring in an expert. You know, you'll have a deeper understanding of what you're supposed to do. You'll have somebody who can help you get it done. We can have somebody who helps you when the problem arises. So I'm not sure how else to answer your question. Yes, technically you can get it done. If you're really doing it for yourself, you may want to have at least the lawyer's advice in the back, at least some advice to make sure you're doing it correctly. Because frankly, if you're doing it for the liability reasons and you do it wrong, you don't get the liability protection. So you've wasted your time and money. You might as well, if you're going to go the route, spend a little bit of additional money and make sure it's done correctly. But, you know, everybody's free to represent themselves.
Well, I think we're going to get into another very interesting part of the scenario of opening a business. And it may be something that you use during the business, not just at the opening. But we're talking about copyright, trademark, service marks, and patents. Now, these are ways of protecting intellectual property. And you might want to start with your business name. You might have a trademark or a service mark, depending on the type of business. First of all, why don't you describe the difference between these different items? Copyright, for instance.
A copyright is basically a protection of a text or an image or a series of images. So, you know, it would protect the text on your website. It would protect the novel that you've written or the film that you've made. It would protect your computer code that you drafted if you were a software provider. Anything that gets reduced to a medium that is to be read or viewed is protected by copyright. And that's all handled by the United States Copyright Office in Washington, D.C. A trademark or a service mark, they're really flip sides of the same coin. Trademarks are usually for goods, service marks for services, is basically a protection of brand or a name that is associated in some part of the public's mind with a particular good or service. And so it's basically to prevent somebody from stealing the goodwill that you have built up using, you know, your advertising and the quality of your products from that being stolen by somebody doing, you know, somebody basically ripping you off and going into business and taking advantage of your hard work, building your brand. So that's what a trademark or a service mark is.
Well, what is the difference between the two? Is there any sort of criteria?
Essentially, a service mark protects you in terms of for providing a service, and trademark, it tends to be more for physical goods and things.
I see.
It's kind of a rough distinction.
And also in that area of trademarks and service marks, there are many different kinds of categories, which there are also in copyright. So sometimes it's not so simple, is it, when you have a sort of multi-products and you don't want to spend thousands of dollars on category protection.
Yeah, when you file your trademark application, you are asked to choose among one or more classes. And the classes basically divide the world into different product groups. So you have a group for clothing, and you have a group for food products, and you have a group for electronics, and you know, everything that you can imagine is going to fall into these groups. And your job is to pick where you want your trademark, to where it protects you. Because remember, the idea of a trademark is to protect the link between your name and your product.
Right.
It's not to protect you against any possible use of those words or those names. It's simply to protect the link. And so what the application is doing is forcing you to choose where you are, you know, what space you are in, for lack of a better phrase, where you want your mark to protect you. And yeah, the categories can be confusing. And yeah, you've got to do some homework and some research to figure out which category or categories you are entitled to have a mark for.
Another thing is that you need to search out if the mark exists in the first place, right?
You do need to search out to see what, you know, if the mark has been used. And, you know, the USPTO, the United States Patent and Trademark Office, has a database that is accessible from anywhere for free as to all the marks that have been registered and all the applications and what marks are alive and what marks are dead. And that is an excellent place to see if your mark has basically already been registered by somebody else, or to see if, you know, there's some wriggle room in there where you can get your mark registered because you are in a different space or something, or whether the mark has expired or the like. And the other thing, you can do is use your favorite internet search engine to search the internet to see if other people are using your name. One of the odd things about trademark is that you don't have to register to have a mark. It is not required that you register with the USPTO to claim a trademark. We are a first-to-use jurisdiction and not a first-to-file. So you could literally get your trademark simply by putting your name in commerce and not really have to worry about it. You would have the right. Now, somebody may pick a fight with you because they register the mark later on not knowing that you exist. And one of the advantages of registration is letting the world know that you have the mark. But there's absolutely nothing that actually 100% requires you to register it.
Well, if you do register it, and there has been somebody in the past who's used it, can they go after you, or are you protected against that first user from coming against you?
You asked the could I use LegalZoom question a few minutes ago, and I kind of danced around it and says, yeah, you can. And your question now raises one of the issues as to perhaps why you might not want to do that.
Okay.
The application is simply that. It's simply an application. There's a lot that happens to your application after it's filed. There's somebody back there in the USPTO, for instance, that looks at all of the other names to see if it's already been registered, and they will reject you if it thinks somebody has already made that registration. They will look to see if, in fact, the phrase that you want is actually registrable and that you can actually be registered. You know, I had an unfortunate client that came to me saying, you know, his trademark application was rejected because it was basically too similar to a common family last name that could not be registered, and he could not establish a link between that last name and his new product. You know, and had he talked to somebody ahead of time, he might have understood that this was the wrong time to file an application because it was likely going to be rejected for exactly that reason. You know, there is a process after the application comes by, even if you get by this initial examination, where there is an open season process for contesting the application. And a lot of people, you know, a lot of trademarks go through this process where somebody says, hey, I have this trademark, don't register it. You know, don't register this other person's attempt to get my name. You know, that happens more frequently than not.
What if they have not registered it and you do register it and they're the first user of it? Can you still keep it?
If they are the first user of the trademark,
but not with registering it.
Even if they have not registered, the first to use will win.
What about, is there any kind of statute of limitations on that? For instance, if they don't challenge you for 10 years or 5 years or 10 months.
Well, there is a doctrine that's called latches, L-A-C-H-E-S. If you have a trademark, you have an affirmative obligation to protect your trademark. Basically meaning, you know, you need to keep an eye out for anybody else in your market space who's using your name or a sufficiently similar name to cause confusion. And if you sit on your rights, then basically you lose the exclusivity of your mark. Now, unfortunately, there isn't a bright line, you know, X number of years rule out there. It's kind of an equity, you know, gee, you waited too long. Gee, you knew you should have done something. You know, gee, you implicitly consented, what have you. There's a lot of factors that go into that puzzle. But, you know, yes, it is possible that even though you have the mark, that you, because you haven't, you know, been a tough guy and gone to enforce it and tell people to stop infringing upon it, that you will essentially lose your exclusivity.
Originally, Zabe Nathan came here from France seeking work as an actor and musician in Hollywood. Now he and his wife, Bonnie Glazik, write unusual and impactful songs, often addressing critical issues facing humanity. You can hear their story and some of their exciting music in show number 3 with Zabe Nathan and Bonnie Glazik in our Threshold Radio Archives in VegasAllNetRadio.com and YouTube. Here is one of their songs, Fooled Me.
Boots in Manhattan is a coming-of-age novel by Ray Boylan and Johnny Bluestar. It is about a young Tom Boots Raymond who grows up in New York in the 1940s, who was a member of a street gang.
My friends and I were about to start our own game of stickball when Rabbit Lacey, the head of the Rattlers, came up to us and tried to move in on our game. We were called dwarves, the youngest members of this stupid gang.
Hey, Kevin, I need you to get some gloves and some stuff I left at my place.
No, this is our game.
Hey, are you my good little dwarf or what?
You've been calling me a dwarf since I was 6. We're not your personal slaves, pal.
Hey, what is this? A dwarf rebellion? All right, big guy, we ditched the dwarf thing. We make you guys regular rattlers.
No, it's too late.
He looked at Jay and me. We looked away. Rabbit was now angry, and he pushed Kevin hard with the palms of his hand. Kevin tried to ram him in the stomach, but he stepped aside, throwing Kevin into the curb where he fell to the ground, bleeding profusely at the knee. Still, he managed to get up.
My street.
Kevin shouted at Rabbit, pointing at him with an angry index finger.
Find out more by Googling Boots in Manhattan, a 1940s coming-of-age novel, part one of the novel series The Foot Soldier by Ray Boylan and Johnny Bluestar. Google with the words Boots in Manhattan, Ray Johnny Kindle. That's Boots in Manhattan, Ray Johnny Kindle.
We're nearing the end of our program. We have been delighted to hear some salient truths about opening a small business by Charles Rick Perry. Can you tell us something about your current contact information in case any of our listeners would like your help?
Sure. My website is www.crperrylaw.com. You can reach me directly at Rick, R-I-C-K, at crperrylaw.com. That's probably the best way to reach me.
I want to thank you so much for being with us, and we wish you well. And if you want to get a hold of Rick, now you know how. We will be talking to you later. Thanks so much.
Johnny, thanks for having me.
You're welcome.
Join us again on Threshold Radio. We go out with a wonderful rendition by Patricia Welch of Edith Piaf's song, La Vie en Rose.
Des yeux qui font baisser la mière, un rire qui sous-perçait sa bouche, voilà la portrait sans retouche de l'homme qu'est la Charpentière. Quand il me prend dans ses bras, il me parle tout bas, j'avoue la vie en rose. Il me dit des mots d'amour, des mots de tous les gens, et ça me fait quelque chose. Il est entré dans mon de bonheur dont j'ai connu la cause. Il a pour moi ma pluie dans la vie, il me le dit la journée par la vie. Et dès que je alors je sens en moi mon cœur qui bat. De mon plume finie, au grand bonheur qui pense aux place, des émois des chagrins s'efface, au rêve on a mori. Quand il me prend dans ses bras, il me parle tout. Je vois la vie en rose. Il me dit des mots d'amour, des mots de tous les gens, et ça me fait quelque chose. Il est entré dans mon cœur, une part de bonheur dont j'ai connu la cause. Il a pour moi ma pluie dans la vie, il me le dit la journée par la vie. Et dès que je l'aperçois, alors je sens en moi